This list is exactly what it says at the beginning there. It's not a reading list. I'm going to use all of these materials and draw on them. The whole point about this course is that it's an introduction to an enormous field which will take you the rest of your life, I hope. And in fact, I have a reading list which people are taking the rest of their life reading now. Now, I do get so fed up with people coming saying, I can't get through the reading list. If anybody says that, I'll bash them, metaphorically. So I think the thing is that the materials is there. And it does say neither complete nor rigid, which means you can add to it if you want to. Now, the structure of the course is then that I'll go through an enormous amount of material, referring to it as quickly as I can, and as indicatively as I can. You don't get the idea of the course. Second thing, this course is called American, is in connection with American studies. What I mean by that is that it's designed as a way of making visible an environment, and it's very difficult to know where you are. It's even more difficult to know somebody else's culture, taking it, some of you here are not Americans. I think the environment is becoming increasingly invisible, in fact, in America, for Americans. It's very difficult to know exactly where you are. And in the American Studies Department in the university I was lecturing at, I did a very short course on methodology of how you make the environment visible, that's all. So the third thing I want to say to you is that most of this course is methodology. And if that sounds frightening, I think you must have been badly taught. I think it's very much to do with techniques of how you lay out information to get at what is there. That is not symbols of it or metaphors of it, which is like stupid, I take it, but what it is. So we're concerned with techniques of access, very much. That is how it's designed. Lastly, in these introductory blahs, is this, that you'll discover that a great deal of what we're going to look at is not written by Americans at all. The answer being that if anybody thinks the American culture is isolated, or ever has been, or there's something called an American culture, which you can draw a thick red line around, you're out of your mind. Because there never has been, that strongly delimited cultural structure. And so what one has to find out is, what are those limits? If there are boundaries, what are they? If we are going to be concerned with delineations, what sort of delineations are they? And we'll be concerned very much, in fact, with the nature of limit, the nature of boundary, the nature of holding a thing into position such that it is not rigid. After all, culture isn't its process. And the biggest problem we have is to think of things in terms of process and not let them slip through our fingers. This is what I mean by technique and methodology. It's not at all easy. The way into it, of course, through these techniques is a cop-out, really. What I'm saying is that these books do have lines around them. I mean, they're called Henry Adams, The Education of Henry Adams. Like, Andrew, pick it up. There's an object, and it's got a line around it, you see what I mean? More or less. I mean, if you examine it in terms of molecular physics, it doesn't have a line around it. So that, in fact, even that is an illusion, as they say. This will become very clear as we go along, that in fact it's the process, the discussion of the process is in fact the discussion of the culture. What I'm going to do today, after I've given a little bit of a spiel first of all, is to go through these passages, so just bear with me for a minute. Also, I've got some charts. This course is nothing if not spatial. It is in fact intended to be a map, a field, a constellation, a collage, or all those words. It is strictly non-linear. And if you think it's a sentence of cause and effect, just drop it. The first person I want to talk about isn't on your reading list at all. It doesn't really matter. I mean, the whole order of this course, I must say straight off, is in the order. It is not fixed in any sense. And this list of this collection of passages that I had typed out here is purely arbitrarily in that order. There's no question of any kind of linearity involved here. One of the most important books being used in America now, and is in the sense of materials, a book by a man called Thomas S. Kuhn, K-U-H-N, and it's called The Structure of Scientific Revolution. Thomas S. Kuhn, K-U-H-N, The Structure of Scientific Revolution, 1962, and I'm using the second edition of 1969, and it deals with the structure of scientific revolution. But it has a methodological program which you keep finding cropping up now in a great deal one reads coming out of America. In fact, quite casually, I mean, it isn't stated. One notices the vocabulary of this man and the way he looks at things is used. That's what I mean by materials, you understand. Not like, you know, sort of hanging on to the thing and not digesting it. And his basic, I want to start off by using some of his ideas, or presenting some of his ideas to you, so that you see the kind of thing we're involved in here, and what one means by process. And by scientific revolutions, Kuhn himself, to a certain extent, and the rest of us completely, are taking over that to mean all knowledge, which it literally does. I'm quoting some, and I'll try and tell you when I am quoting and when I'm not. First of all, you see, on page one of the book, the key word crops up. He says, science is a constellation of facts, theories, and methods. And it's that word constellation, which is a non-linear structure, straight off. And you will see as the course goes on that we're concerned with that in music, we're concerned with that in films, we're concerned with that in happenings, environments, theatre, the lot. I mean, the theatre programme at the Roundhouse right now is a constellation of ever. In fact, that's where it's at right now, as far as theatre is concerned. Science is a constellation of facts, theories, and methods. It doesn't say facts or theories or methods, and it doesn't say that facts come first and then theories and then methods. It's just a constellation. That is a set of relationships, a spatial set of relationships. There's no precedence here. It's a very, very important matter. So the book turns out to be, there's so much we have to get into. I think you'll see if you haven't understood this already in your studies. So much of what we have to do is an attack on the history of knowledge as it's written, and that is as if somehow it was a linear development by accumulation. That is, that you have a linear chronology and it all accumulates. That is, that we live in a kind of sentence. I mean, if you want a pun on that, you can. But I mean it just that way. I think education is a sentence, largely. John? Okay. This incremental process, then, doesn't describe anything accurately at all, alone. For instance, as Kuhn says, when was oxygen discovered? Who first conceived energy conservation? These are the wrong sorts of questions. So, next point he makes, out-of-date theories are not in principle unscientific because they've been discarded. And he goes on, that choice, however, makes it difficult to see scientific development as a process of accretion. Now, this change in thinking, then, is really a revolution in the study of science. See, the basic point is, and this comes out in a great deal of philosophy that I'm trying to show you as well, and it's very important for contemporary thinking, is this. The point is that there is no direct relationship between methodology and conclusion in science at all, which is kind of exciting and very nice, because it means you don't know where you are, and that is always the best position to be in. If you're trying to discover something, you know a certain amount of the field you're in, and that's it. And he says that the differentiation of early schools of science was not by method, but by, I quote, their incommensurable ways of seeing the world and of practicing science in it. And again, you see, that is a spatial idea. They're inside a world, and they practice science inside that. In other words, if you can't practice your knowledge, unless you have a good idea of your environmental space. But, and he goes on, an apparently arbitrary element compounded of personal and historical accident is always a formative ingredient of the beliefs espoused by a given scientific community at a given time. Alternatively, you can say there are no accidents, which makes equal sense. Because as soon as you recognize that something is accidental and you start to use it, then you're in a condition of use, and it's not an accident anymore. It becomes part of the next stage. Anybody who knows anything about jazz knows what that's like. That accidents are everything. So, an apparently arbitrary element, I'm quoting, compounded of personal and historical accident, is always a formative ingredient of the beliefs espoused by a given scientific community at a given time. This is what is called psychohistory. That is not my term, that is the current common term. Which means most history is completely ridiculous, you've probably discovered. I mean, the way it's written, it's computer writing, it's weird. Right, next point. The problem becomes that given the structure of authoritarian societies, states, I quote, research as a strenuous and devoted attempt to force nature into the conceptual boxes supplied by professional education becomes its definition. the strenuous and devoted attempt to force nature into the conceptual boxes supplied by professional education. So what we need to explore is, now quoting again, whether research could proceed without such boxes, whatever the element of arbitrariness in their historic origins and occasionally in their subsequent development. And this is the point where the idea of scientific revolution comes in. That is, there is a set of circumstances, and then which are related, and then there proceed a number of anomalies which subvert the practice of that structure, the practice of that constellation. That is, that traditional practice is subverted by anomalies which are discovered as you practice it. That is, things that will not fit, or accidents you come across. Once you say nature is not in boxes, then you're in the position of having to find out for yourself. So a new set of commitments comes about, and the shift necessary from those commitments is the revolution. And he defines it as the tradition-shattering complement to the tradition-bound activity of normal science. The tradition-shattering complements to the tradition-bound activity of normal science. But, and this is the thing that makes it more exciting than even that, is that each revolution is not just a transformation of a constellatory thing we can call a particular discipline. Everything changes. It's like Marshall McLuhan's idea that every technological piece of information, every technological invention changes the whole environment, all of it. And that's what I mean by the fact that the environment is consistently invisible. It's very difficult to see what it is. Particularly now when technological invention proceeds at such a rate, it's very difficult to see what the changes are, you know. I mean, a long time after it's happened, sociologists in books like New Society come on like, what is the meaning of colour television? Just what is the effect on the environment of this? I mean, everywhere from like walking down the street to like in bed. So it's concerned with the transformation of the world, not only within which the scientific work is done locally, but as it radiates out. That is, that when Newtonian physics, which is largely based on gravity, when physics based on the Newtonian conception of the inertia forces of gravity and so on, suddenly has to cope with the electronic fields, so that the principles of energy which Newton expounded have to include something else. This is not just a scientific revolution in any sense. It's a redescription of the environment as a whole. So that Maxwell's and Einstein's equations in physics have the same effect. And we'll be going into that quite a bit in connection with Werner Heisenberg quite shortly. So, a new theory then always impinges on the other areas of special competence. It's never a simple addition, that is, that's the point. It's never the next thing in a line of accumulative increment. It is always a revolutionary process. This isn't like one thing after another adding up, you see. It's never a simple addition, never part of a linear increment, never an isolated event, it's part of a network. And here's another phrase like the constellation phrase. Kuhn's idea is the network of theory. But that network is not rigid, it's a shifting process. It's not like a spider's web which you catch things. The new theory, or the new piece of evidence, requires the reconstruction of prior theory and the re-evaluation of prior fact, an intrinsically revolutionary process that is seldom completed by a single man and never overnight, I'm quoting. A new theory or piece of wisdom, evidence, requires the reconstruction of prior theory and the re-evaluation of prior fact, an intrinsically revolutionary process that is seldom completed by a single man and never overnight. That is, to summarize so far, it's a combination of quantitative transformation and qualitative transformation. And one finds oneself in that area, recognizing the quantitative transformation, the qualitative. And as this course will demonstrate very clearly, and we were talking about this the other day, it is always primary to look at the quantitative changes, as far as I can see. I mean, I don't think it's primary in any other sense. I think it's useful in that. I mean, primary in that sense. But I don't think I want to discuss that. And I think the best thing is let that emerge, and point to it when it comes up between now and June. The best, by the way, the best set of examples I know of this is a book which I find completely gripping. It's in a Penguin book called The Science of Matter. It's just come out. I don't know if you've seen it. It's a beautiful thing. I'm halfway through it, so I haven't finished it yet, but I still think it's good. And I'm going to say it's good. It's called The Science of Matter, and it's edited by a man called M.P. Crossland, Crossland. Came out this year, 1971. And it's a documented history of the process of describing matter since pre-Platonic physics to now. And if at the end of that you aren't convinced that there is nothing except process and descriptions, and that objectivity is only part of the process, and that subjectivity is only part, and we need the other techniques besides subjective, objective, and all these stupid, you know, either-or dichotomies, I'd be very surprised. It's a marvelous book, I must say. It's beautifully done. The passages quoted are marvellously put together, extremely interesting. Particularly in the 1970, which is the crucial area, you know, like the changes in atomic physics. And but if you just glance through it, or you just read the bits in front of each section that the man Crossland himself writes, you'll see in fact what I mean. So that's it. That's the example for use for all this. It is not abstract in any sense, of course. Having said that, one must add that textbooks which expound the body of an accepted theory and its applications and experiments and so on, like Newton's Principia or Lyell's Geology, I'm quoting Kuhn here, serve for a time implicitly to define the legitimate problems and methods of a research field. Textbooks serve for a time implicitly to define the legitimate problems and methods of a research field. For a time, notice. That means it doesn't have boundaries, it doesn't have limits, as soon as you say for a time. And notice the phrase, another word here, field. So we have constellation, process, network, field. How spatial images. Now, the expounding of this body of accepted theory, we're talking about here, which serves for a time to define, contains two characteristics which are important ones for us. First, the achievement of this expounding is sufficiently unprecedented to attract adherence away from other modes of scientific activity. It's a very human thing, is what I'm saying. It isn't just a question. It's a question it's very much a question of beliefs and adherence in that sense. This is a very important matter because it means that if you can't get adherence, the psychological weight against you is such that you would have to have extra courage and energy to carry on. But already we've noticed that it's impossible to carry things through on your own overnight, and here's a big problem immediately. That is why one should support innovation anyway, to my mind, because I think it's terribly cruel to make people expend more courage than necessary. Second, these structures are sufficiently open-ended to leave all sorts of problems for redefinition. That is, they're not enclosed in any sense. I mean, textbooks just have imaginary lines around them, is what one says. They look like objects. Now, what this structure is called is the word that keeps coming up, now I notice, in discussions in American writing, is the word paradigm. P-A-R-A-D-I-G-M. And that is, it means a pattern. That is a spatial thing. Taken from the Greek verb meaning to show side by side. That is not to make metaphors, not to make symbols, but to put things together so that they relate, so that they're visible. Nothing stands for anything else in this universe at all. Primary. A paradigm, then. P-A-R-A-D-I-G-M. So, we're talking about a shared paradigm as the unit. That is, it's a set of concepts, laws, theories, points of view, whatever you like. It's a unit, it's a paradigm, it's just that kind of pattern. Now, what we're talking about is the transition from one paradigm to another via revolution. This is the normal development of science. And the obvious example, and it's the one that Kuhn uses at this point, is the transition from Newtonian characterization of light to the characterization of light offered by Max Planck and Einstein and so on. It's a very obvious one, but there are many, many others you must understand. That is the most obvious, I think. Okay, next point, and this will become increasingly important as this course goes on. One of the ways the revolution takes place from one paradigm to another is fact gathering. Now, this is far more nearly a random activity than the subsequent paradigm makes it appear to be. That's the point. I mean, when one says paradigm, one is in terrible danger of making it closed, you see. But fact gathering, it tends to be much more random activity than it suggests. I mean, the point is, you can't say, I want this revolution that way. Because if you did, you'd be like filling into the future area everything you already know. And that is stupid, which is like most politicians, particularly revolutionary ones. That's why revolutions keep collapsing, I think, politically, is that they keep being projected ahead, complete. And then you spend all your energy correcting them. And then some nasty bourgeois idiot will come along and say, aha, it didn't work. And this is a genuine and very important problem, to my mind, speaking of men deeply concerned revolution. It's important, then. And I've been reading lately a marvellous book called Physics and Beyond, and this is by one of the great 20th century physics experts, physics theorists, Werner Heisenberg, H-E-I-S-E-N-B-E-R-G, Werner Heisenberg, called Physics and Beyond, came out last year, and it's fascinating. It's a sort of book that one wants to read with The Science of Matter and Kuhn's book, because here is Heisenberg talking about conversations, walks, sittings with, eatings with, making music with Niels Bohr, Einstein, Planck, Pauli, and all the great physicists of the beginning of the 20th century. And it's from those moments when nothing is being planned, nothing is being looked at as a closed paradigm for change, that is very clear many of the major innovations in the structure of our environment came about. It's a marvellous book. It proves once and for all that the sitting in a laboratory mugging over formulas, or like sitting at home reading your books and so on, is really only part of it. And what part of it depends very much on you, but it certainly is only part. That the innovatory act includes the random as a vital part. Now, I'm not talking about statistical randomness either. I better add quickly. For those of you mathematicians. So there's a thing to be said here then about textbooks, particularly marvellous ones like Pliny and Bacon and things like that. This huge encyclopedic. One of the things you don't get so much now is like Pliny and Bacon and Newton's Principia and Darwin's Origin of Species. That is huge works which seem to reach out and try and encyclopedically cover the world, cover the known world, inside a single paradigm of information. Nowadays, the vital things tend to be like an article in the back pages of Nature or something. You have to watch it. So, I mean, it's even more difficult to notice where the bang has occurred these days. And you have to have good friends among people in every field action. Otherwise, you lose. What happens inside these big encyclopedic works is that they are juxtaposed, and again, notice the word that I'm using, a fact that some of which go here and some of which don't, and that's their great strength. There are things in these big volumes that later prove revealing with others, which at the time remained too complex or too difficult to understand, and weren't integrated really into the theory at all. If you read Francis Bacon's great works of encyclopedic fact-gathering, theorizing, and so on, you'll see that sometimes the prose style carries him over enormous gaps. It's like Fitzgerald's The Great Gatsby, the plot line isn't complete, and one doesn't worry, you know, unless you're an idiot critic. But the kind of loose ends, as it were, or the accidents, or the bits that are made to cohere in another way, except relationally, are very important. This is methodology. This is absolutely primary, believe me. And of course, these big works do something which now is impossible to do, and that is they pretend omniscience. They pretend that a single man is in fact stationary enough to encompass a great deal of information that is now completely discredited, because in actual fact nobody's stationary ever. Obviously, by the way, but I mean it wasn't so obvious to those people. One is in a process. Apart from the fact that you're moving anyway. This breakdown then at the end of the 19th century in omniscience is very important. I mean, it's the reason why Alain Robbe-Grillet attacks Balzac and the great 19th century novelists with their knowingness, like War and Peace, you know, War and Peace. I mean, the thing about War and Peace is that Tolstoy says that he knows what goes on inside Natasha's head at any given moment. Not only that, he knows exactly how history operates. There's a marvelous moment where Kutuzov does nothing before the Battle of Borodino at all. Just sits in his tent and all the generals go around like, what are you going to do, what are you going to do? And he just all sits there. And it's divine inertia, because things are going to happen anyway, which is Tolstoy writing history backwards, and he's a bloody liar. I mean, he's a crass idiot. You know, I mean, if that's how you feel about it, he might never have been, no point being born, it seems to me. It's like, you know, sitting there. So there's a very important matter we're concerned with here, and that is, like, if it's impossible to know it all, because of this complete change in attitudes of against the illusion that you have a single point of view which you can operate and know it all, what do you have? Let's just put it on one side for a moment, because I think it'll be clear what we have as the cost generates. In fact, well, I can say straight off, in the sense that we have structures of information which, in fact, in their operational methods, give you confidence that you can, in fact, find yourself in a bigger field. Question of knowing how to operate, basically, not knowing what is inside the operation. That's just a confidence point. I better mention here a great man who I'm going to talk about later on, called Charles Forth, who's only just coming up right now. Oh, I didn't bring anything, never mind. He's written a book called The Book of the Damned. American guy. It's in paperbacks around, compendium and so on, have it. Charles Forth. And The Book of the Damned is a book of facts which have never been included in scientific theories. In fact, he had a whole wall in his office, in his room, of pigeonholes in which he kept these facts. They accumulated, he did it all that. He lived just down the road here. He lived in Brisbane Museum for some time, annoying everybody by every now and then publishing a few sections of things saying, okay, now where do these fit in your scientific paradigm? And they still don't fit. My favourite one is like, I think it was 1863, I think it was. Pieces of carved Chinese jade descended all over Ireland. And, you know, like, they still haven't worked this one out yet. Like, which is kind of nice. Needless to say, he's a UFO buff. But who isn't? I mean, it seems to be obvious. But the number of things that Fort collected in... Yet another book with a lovely title called Low! Exclamation mark. Which is another collection of these things. It's a startling book. I mean, it's not for the nervous, as they say about late night television movies. I think you have to have a lot of strength to read these damn things, because otherwise you feel everything slipping through your hands, which is not fun. But look at Charles Forth's The Book of the Damned, particularly his Demolition of Darwin, which is a favourite of mine. Point being, you see, Charles Forth makes a very important point for us here, and that is that any paradigm is selective, bound to be. But it is startling how many facts are omitted from paradigms, so that there are paradigms, you see. I mean, I think we ought to put this at the beginning of our course, make quite certain that we're in a state of humility, and that there's no point in pretending that of completion, do you understand? It's a very important matter. Next point, then, I'm using Kuhn and Forth here, mistaken beliefs, that is, mistaken by the paradigm, aren't necessarily useless or wrong. It's like the accident business, you see. It might be just what you want, the mistake, for the next revolutionary stage. For instance, the classic case is the belief that electricity was a fluid. Now, that's been pretty discredited now. At least there's still, flat earthers around about electricity. And you still come across weird people who think it's a fluid. It's usually part of a lot of other weirdness, I may say, in those people. I better add quickly. Right, it's precious bodily fluids. That's the man said in that great film. Yeah, right. well, that's what I meant. Mm. It's a very sexy thing. You think electricity is a fluid? I mean, you know, kind of odd. I think that fluid contains electricity. That's something else. But the result of the idea of electricity being a fluid led to a thing called the Leyden jar. And it was Benjamin Franklin's examination of the Leyden jar which made him think about electricity in certain other ways, and see, and so on, like that. The title of a marvellous book by Harry Schlocker called No Voice is Wholly Lost. So accidents and mistakes, then. I mean, putting inverted commas around accident and mistake, huh? Take on different aspects when they're considered in a field, a revolutionary field of process. That is, once you in a condition of saying fixed authoritarian structures are continually undermined, continually subverted, then you can see that accidents and mistakes only look like accidents and mistakes in any full-blooded sense by people who want authoritarian conditions. So a paradigm then never explains all the facts with which it can be confronted. That was the point of what I put on the back here, you see, on the front here. The list of materials is neither rigid nor complete. This is a map of intersections to provide information. Well, I have a nice little quote here, one of my favorite quotations from Francis Bacon, where he says, "Truth emerges more readily from error than from confusion," which, you know, is something to live up to. I'd like to work that one out. I must say, if I could live like that, I'd be very happy. It's rather hard, actually, because so often men clinging to older views are simply read out of the process. And of course, some of them just have to be, except they were human and tried like the rest of us. A lot of them, of course, stay on in university departments, which is kind of sad. One major use of the paradigm is this, and this is a very important matter for us, I may say. I like to give us confidence looking at this enormous amount of material. Is this, that the individual scientist, that's us, can take it for granted, once he understands the paradigm, that is the constellation, the field, what it looks like, how it is, where you are inside it. You can take it for granted, then, that you need no longer build the field anew. You don't have to start from scratch. You don't have to start from first principles and justify your use of each concept as you use it, you see? This is, again, what I was talking about in terms of the structure just now. Now, of course, one of the problems about getting the paradigm box changed is resistance of information from outside it. It is very difficult, as we all know, and as I certainly know, is that if you're in a state of related information and you feel yourself and you know yourself inside that field, it's difficult psychologically and in terms of one's day-to-day existence to understand that it is in fact a temporary matter, and one has to watch the ways in which you are resisting information continually. Not at all. I mean, I'm not trying to say it's an easy thing. It's very difficult. One resists all sorts of things, like says, "Ah, the hell of it!" Like, "I can't believe that," or "It's ridiculous." "The man's a fool," or like that. Because I think it's a question of feeling stable and confident. You know. There's this factor. But to get reborn, you have to feel unstable. So, most research then goes on, and you may want to do this, by the way, and there's nothing shameful about it. We all do a lot of this. Most research, in fact, articulates the phenomena and theories inside the paradigm, you see. And this is something one has to do. That is, the paradigm supplies great information. Something we have to do is to articulate the phenomena and the theories. It's a highly important activity. And Thomas Kuhn has a great deal of examples in his book. But the trouble is that we tend to become, in our theories and experiments, what he calls paradigm dependent. Like, you know, the Pentagon. Or, you know, like Selsdon Man. As Mr. Heath is called. And that kind of, you know, paradigm dependency. Discussions, I think, of, like, right now, of the Karl Marx thing, seems to be paradigm dependency if ever. They all know what it is, and they keep talking about it. That is, and if you check it in terms of, like, paradigm dependency, you can get a good access inside that thing. So what we want then is desertions from the paradigm. And these desertions, Kuhn calls the pivots about which scientific revolutions turn. That is, it's a great difference, you see, between deserting the paradigm and what is called, and you've heard this thing, called problem solving and puzzle solving. I mean, sociology is full of it. It's a lot of crap. I mean, you know, there's the idea that somehow everything is a jigsaw puzzle or a Chinese crossword puzzle has to be solved is not innovatory. There's nothing innovative about jigsaw puzzles, as far as I can see. Nothing innovative about a puzzle at all. Puzzles aren't puzzling, I think, is the thing one says. They're strictly for the bird. I mean, they are so boring. You know, I mean, you see people doing crossword puzzles and or chess problems or these dull businesses. I think that they're just a waste of human energy because, in fact, they're not puzzling. They're just illusions of competence, in my mind, that you can do it again. Who wants to do it again? I can't see that. I'm alone in this one, I know, but it worries me. I had to teach my nephew chess because my sister begged me to. And it really went against the grain, because I wanted to play chess, and she knew it. And he wanted me to, and I wish I hadn't, now. What a fool thing to do. So there it is. Poor little lad. So he's stuck with it now. He cheats very well, I must say. Which I think is, like, hopeful, right? Yeah. Okay, then. This paradigm, then, contains also a criterion for choosing problems. And the problem is not to choose the problems inside the paradigm. To choose, if you like, to be paradoxical problems outside it. What one wants, then, is to try and understand that one of the characteristics of the paradigm is it's taken for granted that there are problems which have solutions, you see. I'm not saying there aren't, but there is that taken for grantedness which one has to resist a little. So, and the trouble is that you know how it is. I mean, one in one's own life, but certainly in academic life, I suppose the word academic means this, that anything outside the situations and puzzles and problems that the paradigm proposes is tended to be dismissed as, like, metaphysical, that's a key word, you know? Or, like, it's another discipline. You know, you've heard that one. Yes, I have. Or it's too problematic, or it isn't worth the time. I've heard that one, too. These are things one has to watch. Last round before coffee. But there is a problem here, clearly, that once a set of information is related into the status of a paradigm, it is only declared invalid if an alternative candidate takes place. And one of my favorite sentences in Kuhn is this. It's a very important one. No process yet disclosed by the historical study of scientific development at all resembles the methodological stereotype falsification by direct comparison with nature. No process yet disclosed by the historical study of scientific development at all resembles the methodological stereotype of falsification by direct comparison with nature. And that is where it's at, that the paradigm never encloses all of nature. Just never. Einstein thought it did. He thought God was a mathematician that just sort of drew lines around, you know. He resented very deeply complementary studies and things like indeterminacy principles. He thought that, he didn't think that God would let human beings down like that. His theory of relativity, it wasn't intended to be relative at all. It was intended to be a formula which replaced like a grid over the universe and said that is God's control structure. And Werner Heisenberg, including his books, marvelous statements of Einstein at meetings in America and Germany, fighting all the way against indeterminacy principles, against random structures and so on. It's very interesting. So the greatest man like in physics of that time was up against it. So finally then, the crisis of the paradigm is that novel information not only causes a change in that paradigm, but it's a change in the worldview, and a re-education process starts. And to use another phrase, which we're going to use, you know, the old German word, that is the whole Gestalt is transformed, the form of relationships. I think it's a quick way to say it. The whole Gestalt is transformed. And again, to repeat myself here, it may be more or less visible. That is the difficulty. Last quotation, page 144 of Kuhn. any new interpretation of nature, whether a discovery or a theory, emerges first in the mind of one or few individuals. By nature, there he means the basic propositions of chemicals, information, energy in structures. Any new interpretation of nature, whether a discovery or a theory, emerges first in the mind of one or two individuals. It is they who first learn to see science and the world differently. And their ability to make the transition is facilitated by two circumstances that are not common to most other members of their profession. Invariably, their attention has been intensely concentrated upon the crisis-provoking problems. Usually, in addition, they are men so young or so new to the crisis-ridden field that practice has committed them less deeply than most of their contemporaries to the world view and rules determined by the old paradigm, which is exactly where we start. I mean, Kate, I take it that we are so young or so new to this damn thing, because I certainly am new, I'm not so young, to this crisis-ridden field, that we are less committed, we're committed less deeply to the old paradigm, I take it. This is a very important statement, is it not? Invariably, their attention has been intensely concentrated upon the crisis-provoking problems. Usually, in addition, they are men so young or so new to the crisis-ridden field that their practice has committed them less deeply than most of their contemporaries to the worldview and rules determined by the old paradigm. Having said that, I must add, quoted that from Kuhn, I must add something which will appear continually in this course. It's still too linear. In the sense that it does still look, doesn't it, like a line. It's still, the idea somehow there's a paradigm here, a paradigm here, a paradigm here, there's a lapping process going on, you see. It's still a bit too linear here. And the way to handle that is to say that the future causes the past just as much as the past causes the future. One has to get that really under one's belt. The fact is that again and again and again, it's like, what is it, Willem de Kooning, the great American painter, saying, you know, somebody asked him, what has influenced you in the past? And he just said, no, I don't believe nothing influenced in the past. I influenced the past. Meaning that when you look at one of his paintings and you understand it, you look at somebody else painting the past very differently. And it happens continually. I mean, the way we read Newton's Principia now, or the Puritan documents of the Plymouth Bay Company, is very different to what was read like 10 years ago, 20 years ago, 30 years ago, 40 years ago. See what I mean? We keep influencing and changing the past. So it becomes increasingly like a space that we live in and are at home, you know? So I have to check that before this, what I say, because it begins to get just a bit linear, doesn't it, you know? Like the process begins to be a continuously forward one, too much. It is a forward one, of course, in the sense that people come after us and a few before us. But in terms of the history of human beings, it's not. I was going to get some coffee for God's sake.